KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Let me begin, just if you've had your life turned upside down by the Woolsey fire that I know has affected thousands of our listeners, you have our concerns. If you've lost your home, you have our condolences. We are so, so very sorry. All the loss that's occurred as a result of this fire, and of course it's not over yet. With the very latest on the Woolsey Fire Public Information, Officer Captain Eric Scott joins us. Captain, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So what is the latest on the performance of the fire this morning? Have the winds kicked up much?
They have. We're right in the middle of our second Santa Ana wind event. It started yesterday. We expect it to go until Tuesday. So the acreage continues to grow for the Woolsey Fire. We're now up to 91,500 acres. So it's almost hit 100,000 acres. We did get that little lull in the wind. That allowed us to finally get some containment on this wind-driven fire. So we're able to have a 20% containment as of 7 a.m. this morning. Unfortunately, we did have two fatalities, and we did have three firefighters that were injured. So it does show the potential devastating consequences of this historic fire.
Now, the two fatalities, they were on Mulholland Highway, is that right?
That is our understanding, correct. And that's under active investigation by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to determine the surrounding circumstances that led up to that tragic incident. But, you know, for your listeners, it's important for them to think about the canyon locations. When there is a fire burning through the Los Angeles, Malibu, Santa Monica canyons, especially wind-driven, it moves like a freight train. You absolutely do not want to be driving into canyons, in particular what we call mid-slope roads, where you have that turn and it, you really have an alignment with the topography moving uphill on that road. That's a natural area where the fire is going to burn and nothing will stop it. That's one of the biggest challenges of the Woolsey fire. This is not a normal brush fire. If it's a normal brush fire, we do this. We anchor, we flank both sides of it, we pinch it together, and we have helicopters take out the heat on the top of it. When you have a Santa Ana wind event, it moves through so fast that all we can do is predict its location based upon historical data, topography of the canyons, direction of the wind, and get individuals to evacuate out of those areas. So it's so important for people to heed evacuation warnings, meaning that you need to be aware that it's headed your way, and mandatory evacuations or evacuation orders. That is non-optional. That means you need to leave.
Is there any sort of a timetable at this point for when Malibu residents might be able to come back into their homes?
That's the freshest burn. In particular, the southwest portion of the fire continues to grow. That's where we're seeing it move. So it started 5 days ago in Simi Valley, ripped through that area, started to go to Thousand Oaks, Agoura Hills, Westlake Village, jumped the 101, started burning through Malibu Canyons, and now we're seeing the most action in the southwest portion. So we need to wait for the wind event to die down before those fresh burn areas are allowed to have people come back, because we have 370 homes that were destroyed. That number may go up. But there's also 57,000 homes that are still threatened in that area. When you have a big house with that smoldering, and you have the chance now of attic fires to start taking off, one of those embers can fly a very far distance and create spot fires. Then we run around chasing these spot fires to put them out before they get big. Point is, there's multiple challenges that are having to be overcome in those Malibu areas, in those canyons. We have what's called extreme fire behavior. So our firefighting efforts are focused, and they will remain focused, to protect life and property. But we have steep terrain, you have limited access, you have challenging roads, and these are just some of the things that your firefighters are all pulling together from not just the local community, but across the state and really across the nation at this point.
Woolsey Fire Public Information Officer Captain Eric Scott is with us. Now, I know that over the past several hours, you've had firefighters arriving from neighboring states, coming down from the Pacific Northwest, in from Arizona and the like. Are they largely going to be spelling exhausted local firefighters, or are they going to actually bolster numbers that if you do get flare-ups, you're going to be able to throw more personnel into fighting those fires?
We're putting those individuals into formation of strike teams and to be put in areas that we call divisions. We're very organized, very delineated areas of control. And they're being sent to the ground in the burn areas to either do structure protection and defense, where they're saving homes, where fire may be coming to, or at this point, putting out a lot of these hot spots, some of these flared up attic fires. They're mostly doing that. But it's got a huge rolling impact. Even the City of Los Angeles Fire Department, we pulled firefighters from Orange County up to backfill some of the fire stations in the City of Los Angeles, because so many of those resources are pushed up north to this Woolsey fire. So we all play well in the sandbox together.
I just got a tweet from Ventura County Fire Department, the PIO, that two new brush fires, Lynn Ranch and Thousand Oaks, just a quarter-acre fire at Calle Las Casas, structures are threatened, fire running toward the Venture Park area, and then New Start Highway 118 at Rocky Peak. Those have just come in. And perhaps these are the kinds of spot fires for members you're talking about?
Yes, it is. And I am a resident of the Lynn Ranch, and family's been sending me photos. It's smoke columns that's growing as we speak right now. And, you know, even family of firefighters, we tell them the same thing, heed evacuation warnings. You know, my actual family will they've packed their belongings. They've predetermined what's important to them. They've placed it in an area that they have it easily accessible. It's in the car, and they're ready to enact and leave when told to leave. So that's what people need to know. And you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up. There is these spot fires that continue to affect new areas of the Thousand Oaks area and adjacent all around the large footprint of the Woolsey fire.
We should mention, of course, West Hills in the City of Los Angeles. The area west of Valley Circle continues under an evacuation. Yesterday, they had flames burning right up to one of the residential streets there. Malibu continues under evacuation, the Malibu Lake area. Residents are coming back into Westlake Village, though. Is that correct, Captain Scott?
That's been under discussion today. Westlake Village is unique because it's covered by both the Los Angeles County and the Ventura County. And so you have the great sheriff agencies of both of those that are really handling evacuation and repopulation, as well as protecting homes that have been evacuated. So that's all under active investigation. And then, as you mentioned, too, as you go northeast from there towards the San Fernando Valley and West Hills, that's the City of Los Angeles proper. And that is under active discussion on how to, when to evacuate. But again, we applaud the residents' patience that they're having. We know what it's like to leave your home. And as you just mentioned, these new fires are erupting around the burn area as we speak. We don't want people to be overly frightened, but you absolutely need to remain vigilant. Stay tuned to this radio station or other news agencies. Look at vcemergency.com for Ventura County folks, and make sure you're getting the most information. And I feel it's important to say, too,
I want
the incident commanders, they feel the community's pain. They know that hundreds of homes have been destroyed, but it's important to note that tens of thousands of homes have been saved. And we know that there's fresh emotional and financial scars from the Thomas fire. That was less than a year ago. But firefighters are doing everything they can to mitigate this emergency.
Captain Scott, thank you so much. We appreciate the update. And again, our hearts go out to all those who've lost their homes, who've been evacuated, who've gone through this traumatic experience. Coming up at around 11 o'clock, the Unified Command for the Woolsey Fire will have a brand new update. We'll be bringing that to you live. And as Captain Scott said, keep it right here for continuing coverage. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Let me briefly bring on Malibu City Council Member Lou Lamont, who we talked with on Friday as that fire was exploding and the day was as night because of that thick smoke. Council Member Lamont joining us from the Zuma Beach Lifeguard Headquarters, that a place where so many people evacuated on Friday. Councilman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for publicizing this. It's important for people to know what's going on.
I want to say, first of all, that our hearts are with all the residents and employees in your community, as well as the first responders who were there. Can you update us on what's happening right now with your community?
Well, the first thing, before I talk about any of that, I just want to reconfirm everything that Captain Scott just told you. The reason there's mandatory fire evacuations is that we are still in danger here in Malibu. Some of our neighborhoods have been devastated and some have been untouched. But the thing that's really important to remember, as he said, there is no fire line and the embers are traveling 4 and 5 miles and lodging in eaves and smoldering there. And you know, you don't even know it's going to go on fire and then suddenly it does. So the reason a lot of people are trying to get back into Malibu because the eastern part of Malibu seems untouched, but right now we are still in danger because of these winds.
All right. You've suffered the losses of a number of homes. I was wondering if you at this point know which businesses or landmarks in the community have been lost to the fire.
There have been few businesses affected in the eastern part of Malibu. A few in the western part, but none of the landmark businesses that I know of so far have been affected. But the homes are another matter.
Yeah. And homes, some have burned all the way to the ocean.
Yes, and some of these neighborhoods are just devastated, and it was because of the embers from the winds. And we have now unbelievable support from fire departments, not only from all over L.A. County, but the entire state of California, and they're coming in from Texas and Arizona. We have such a tremendous amount of support that we truly, truly appreciate.
Not to get too far ahead of where we are, because we understand the risk is so high, even as it is, but I assume that you and your colleagues and city staff are already trying to think of, you know, once the city repopulates, what kind of services you can provide. What have those conversations been like?
All those conversations, every agency that is responsible for restoring power in our community is part of these discussions. We are planning a town hall that will be held in Santa Monica tomorrow evening. I don't have exactly the time or place yet, but to try to give people a better idea of what's going on.
All right.
The city has a Facebook page that they post everything that they can on it. If you are out of Malibu listening to this and you want to hear things about your community, please go on Facebook and the City of Malibu page.
And the city has also been very active on Twitter, so I've been able to follow those alerts too, Councilman. Yeah. Just finally, I was wondering, do you know the status of your home at this point?
My home is in the eastern part of Malibu, so far it has been untouched. One of our council members, as you know, is in the hospital, is Jefferson Wagner. My information, which is just secondhand, is that they have taken him out of the ICU and put him in to the next level of care. So it seems that he is getting better, and that's great news for all of us.
Yeah, I'm sure that you and your colleagues are so concerned about his recovery. Thank you for sharing that update. We appreciate it, and we're glad that he's progressing. Councilman Lamont, thank you very much.
Thank you, and keep in touch with us also. Our residents that are on this mandatory evacuation have an idea of what's going on in our town. We're trying to, as many ways as possible, get information out to them so they know when they can come back.
All right. Thank you. Lou Lamont with us. And again, the latest estimate, as we just heard from Captain Scott, of 370 structures that have been destroyed. That's a preliminary count, though. They still have to go through. I think only 15% of the area burned has actually been surveyed. So this is kind of, at this point, still guesstimating the amount of structures that are lost. As the week goes on, we'll have much more definitive word. And once again, coming up at 11, approximately 11 o'clock, we will bring you live the Unified Fire Command update on the very latest developments and hopefully more on the spot fires that have broken out along the northeastern flank of the Woolsey Fire as well. We now turn our attention to the huge week in politics last week with our political experts, Professor Anshmarie Hancock-Alfaro, University of Southern California, where she's political science professor and chair of gender studies at SC, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst, joining us. Well, thank you both for being with us. Professor Hancock-Alfaro, let me begin, first of all, with the midterm election results. We just received the AP calling the congressional race, where Dana Rohrabacher in coastal Orange County appears to have lost his 30-year seat to Democratic challenger Harley Ruda. Katie Hill taking that North L.A. County, Antelope Valley, Ventura County seat from Steve Knight there in that race. Mike Levin, the Democrat, winning in far south Orange County, North San Diego County, and what had been Daryl Issa's seat. And then we have a couple of others that are still too close to call. Your thoughts on what we're seeing here in Southern California with the House?
Well, I think what we're seeing in terms of the House is that the Democratic money that was invested here is bearing some amount of fruit, particularly with regard to the Katie Hill seat that you mentioned. Democrats have been trying to flip that seat for about three or four election cycles. And so the fact that they were really targeting this time, I think from the national level, ended up being the difference there. With Ruda, it was a little bit different in that Ruda used to be a Republican and then, became a Democrat and ran against Rohrabacher. So he's definitely a more moderate Democrat than Hill is, for example. So I think the other important point to take away from some of these Democratic victories is that the Democrats that are going to Congress, the ones that have been elected from Southern California, aren't necessarily a homogenous group the way that we might have expected, just given Southern California politics in general.
In some of the other races, Young Kim leading Gil Cisneros in that North Orange County, South L.A. County race, Mimi Walters leading Katie Porter in the district that includes Irvine, Mission Viejo. And then up in the Central Valley, Josh Harder, the Democrat challenging longtime Congressman Jeff Denham, he's leading in that race. Sean, your thoughts on what's happened here in the House in California?
I mean, three things. Number one, you've got Trump. You've got money. The Democrats really, really, as the professor noted, poured it on. I mean, $15 million in the Walters race, more than that in the Rohrabacher race. So they invested and spent very, very heavily. I am concerned, actually, about the Walters race, and I'm also concerned about the Young Kim race. They should pull it out. But historically, Republicans absentee vote early, and Democrats tend to vote a little bit later. So all the votes that are still out, not all, but many of them tend to trend more favorably towards Democrats. So I think Republicans still have some more heartbreak to see before this is all said and done.
I was going to ask you about that. We're seeing, and not just here in California, but when you look at the Georgia gubernatorial race, the Florida governors and senatorial races, it seems like as these later votes are being counted, they're skewing very heavily Democratic. And is that just a function of the timing of when members of which party vote, Sean?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, historically speaking, older folks tend to vote a little bit earlier, and Republicans, as I mentioned, tend to vote early on their absentee ballots. Democrats tend to bring them in late, sometimes even like I did in this election cycle, fill out your absentee ballot and then just drop it off literally on election day so you can get your little sticker. But again, historically, those trends are Democrats voting later. So that's why I think you're seeing these numbers, not just in California, but across the country.
All right. I did want to ask you also about, you know, some of these other races. Florida going to an unprecedented automatically triggered recount because of how tight the elections are there in the gubernatorial and senatorial race. Ange Marie, your thoughts on what we're seeing there. Let's take Florida first, where it's looking like 2000 all over again.
It really is, to the point where the candidate Andrew Gillum actually conceded and then unconceded. So I think the parallels are uncomfortable for both Democrats and Republicans in this particular race. I think one of the interesting things to note about this automatic recount that's been triggered because the elections are so close, that was a law that did emerge in the aftermath of the 2000 election. So in other words, it's not a longstanding law, you know. It's one that was put forth as some of these challenges around how to properly count the votes and make sure that the votes that are being counted are legitimate is something that's been part of what they've wanted to address.
All right. And as we continue, we'll talk a bit about allegations the Republicans have made of voter fraud, that they've claimed that there has not been sufficient bipartisan oversight of the counting of the ballots. On the Democratic side, there have been concerns about efforts to suppress the vote of Democrats, particularly of African-American voters. We'll talk about those competing claims and particularly how significant they are in such closely contested races as we have in Florida, not to mention the gubernatorial race, where there we have, Stacey Abrams, the Democrat, attempting to become the first African-American governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, the Republican, leading in the current vote count. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, now about 15 minutes away from the scheduled start of our press briefing from the Unified Command of the Woolsey Fire, where yesterday was a pretty good day of making some progress. Then today, with the Santa Anas kicking up, there are some spot fires along the periphery. We're going to keep you updated on the very latest developments right there. But we're also talking politics. A huge week. Everything building up, of course, to the midterm elections and to the California statewide election. And joining me to talk politics, Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst based in the Bay Area, and USC Professor of Political Science, Ange Marie Hancock-Alfaro. Ashmi, I want to talk a bit about where things stand on that Georgia race because of the historic nature of Stacey Abrams' efforts to become the first African-American governor of Georgia. We've heard Brian Kemp, the Republican who's leading, criticizing her for not conceding the race, saying it's impossible for her to close the gap. Your thoughts on him making this demand on her?
Well, I think, one of the things that we often forget about concessions is that concessions are not legally binding. neither are people required to make concessions, nor are people, when they make concessions, required to stand by those concessions. The Secretary of State of each state certifies an election. The workers count the ballots. And so, again, I think this is part of the political pressure that Kemp is trying to put on to say that, perhaps we shouldn't worry about what the actual outcome of the election is. And instead, Stacey Abrams should walk away. I think it is increasingly common that statewide candidates are not going to walk away or not going to, kind of take advantage of this, tradition of conceding elections because of the challenges to voting that have happened so much over the past few years. And also because of some of the very real problems that happened in Georgia on election night with, lawyers having to go to federal judges to extend the hours of particular polling places because so many machines were broken or they weren't, you know, kind of actually ready at the beginning of the morning on Election Day.
Well, and I think we've seen that even in Southern California, where it seems, you know, Katie Porter, the Democrat, Gil Cisneros, the Democrat, you know, it seemed like they were sort of resigned. They were going to lose to the Republican, those seats, but that's still up in the air at this point. And I think we've seen this across the country where this huge number of outstanding ballots at the end of election night, now particularly Democrats that are trailing, are going to be reluctant because we're seeing these huge shifts in the later counts.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think the other piece, you know, for Southern California in particular is, you know, and unfortunately here in L.A. County and other parts of Southern California, there aren't always enough ballots. So that was one of the things that happened during the primary season here in L.A. County, that there was a real struggle for people to cast their votes in person. And so I think, again, all of those things militate towards candidates waiting until all of the ballots are counted before really deciding what they want to do in terms of conceding or not.
I wanted to ask you, Sean, about, you know, in these elections that are expected to be so close, we hear these sorts of narratives that the parties put out there. The Democrats put out the voter suppression narrative that their people are going to be kept from voting because of biased rules and biased voter registries. And then we have from Republicans the narrative that, you know, during the count, Democrats are trying to stack the deck and that there's not proper supervision. Is this just the new normal we're going to be seeing in any close race?
Oh, I think a couple things. One thing for Stacey Abrams, which is important to note, and the reason why she isn't conceding, and I don't think she should concede, under Georgia law, if you do not get 50 plus one vote, there's a mandatory runoff that goes there. So if she can just hang in there, and pick up enough votes, she doesn't actually have to win per se outright. But if she can just get over or get Kemp under that 50%, then she's got a chance at a runoff election. And so she lives to fight another day. So the politics for her makes eminent sense for her to stay in.
And there are more than two candidates allowing that.
That's right. That's right. So but on the issue, yeah, look, is there voter suppression out there? Yeah, I suspect that there probably is. Is it to the extent that Democrats say no? Is there fraud in elections? Yeah, there is. To the extent that Republicans say probably not. But we've got history of both all throughout this country. So you're going to see both sides, I think, politically continue to make those arguments.
And are there ways of making inroads on dealing with those concerns? I mean, protocols for vote counts that would address the Republican fraud claims and protocols for how to handle voter rolls that would protect on the ability to vote issue.
Well, there is. I mean, so from the Republican perspective, they say if you need to go to a Target to write a check or anywhere, get on an airplane, you use a driver's license or some form of ID, and that eliminates voter fraud or lessens voter fraud. From a Democrat perspective, they say, oh, gosh, that's horrible. That's an effort to make it really hard on Democrats, and that's voter suppression. So one person's solution is another person's poison, I guess. So I just think you're going to continue to see this in perpetuity. And now you're seeing in some of these voter and even in California, I mean, got very little coverage. But the motor voter issue, you saw an error somewhere at DMV where people that were not legally in this country were put on the voter rolls. So I just think we've got problems and we're going to continue to have problems. And every time you come up with an electoral solution, there's something else that happens that causes problems.
Well, and fortunately, that DMV error was caught. Secretary of State Alex Padilla said, you know, his office is working to try and fix it. And that it was a new initiative to do the motor voters. So let me also ask you just about some of the other observations. I was looking at a piece, the Wall Street Journal, you know, saying that Elizabeth Warren was kind of a loser in this, despite Democrats taking the House and taking it in impressive fashion, that the candidates that Warren had supported had not done so well, and that her progressive wing of the party didn't do as well. Anshmari Hancock Alfaro, your thoughts on that analysis?
Well, I think that analysis was the analysis in the immediate aftermath of the election. I think when you start to look at who's actually won, you know, in some of these closer races, somebody like a Katie Hill, who we were just talking about.
Katie Porter somebody has like chance.
Absolutely. Or somebody like a Kristen Sinema, who's leading in Arizona for the Senate race there. I think there are people that are very much on kind of this more Elizabeth Warren kind of, you know, track. And so I'm not quite sure that the analysis stands up over time, because this happens to be one of those elections where the Democratic wave that everyone was either worried about if you were a Republican or excited about if you were a Democrat is kind of unfolding over time, as opposed to happening in just one election day.
Sean, are some of the new Democrats, because they're representing districts that have just swung, are they going to have to be, do you think, at all cautious in how progressive they vote?
Well, Larry, I will say, you know, you saw the Mark Penn op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. So now we have Hillary 4.0, which is supposedly going to be Elizabeth Warren's policies and politics on steroids. So, you know, I always get concerned that we have, you know, kind of Freedom Caucus and the Republican side, and that we overreach. But by goodness, thank goodness the Democrats are who they are, because they tend to overreach on the left side of the aisle. So I think that depending on how this presidential race comes out, you're going to see some really, really progressive people fighting it out tooth and nail with more conventional Democrats. And these seats that they did pick up on the Republican side, yeah, there are some progressive women and college-educated Republicans that voted there. But you're not going to hold them by raising, you know, Che Guevara flags and, you know, saying two thumbs up for Fidel Castro if that's the Democratic Socialist message.
Thank you both. That's Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. And our thanks to political scientist at USC, Ansh Marie Hancock-Alfaro.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
We'll continue to bring you updates on that new fire that's burning right alongside the 118 freeway in the area right along the county line, L.A. and Ventura County. 118 looks like right now they've closed between Topanga Canyon Boulevard and Yosemite. So that would take in that county line area there, right there along the rocks of the 118 freeway. We'll keep you updated. Water drops taking place. 866-893-KPCC. If you're in that area, you have anything you can report to us, we'll take your calls. But let me step back and look at just this extraordinary fire challenge that we have had up in Northern California. The campfire that began late last week has claimed more structures than any in the history of California. And now we're looking at, of course, the loss of life that's occurred in both the Northern California and the Southern California fires. Is this the future for us? Seems like each year we have historically large and destructive fires. With me from UC Berkeley, Dean Emeritus at the College of Natural Resources and Professor of Forest Economics, Keith Gillis. Professor, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do you see a long-term shift that's taking place here that's fueling these fires, or do we have any historic nature of, you know, several years in a row of fires of this magnitude?
There are several shifts that are taking place, and all of them combine to this kind of experience we've got going on now. Climate change is real. I believe the scientific consensus on this is so complete that, you know, we're going to experience hotter, drier weather in much of California moving into the future. So what you see out the window, that's one trend. We've been moving people into areas that were previously characterized as forest or shrublands. And so we've moved people out in areas creating more of a wildland-urban interface. And so that trend has been very strong, and most forecasts is for it to continue. We reduced the harvesting level on much of our forest land, not all of it, but a good part of it, and that meant that, you know, we had a buildup in the stocking in the forests, less removals from harvest, more active fire suppression so that we didn't have, you know, underburning of stands up in the Sierra on a 7 to 12-year basis. We might have excluded fire in some areas for 40 or 50 years. And so the buildup on the ground. So all of that combines to say, yeah, we have to get prepared to live in the world that we actually live in, not kind of the world of the past.
One of the things I see is you sort of, you know, articles, and we get this with every fire year, that, you know, we're going to be seeing this, if not worse, year after year. But I wonder at some point, as we have massive fires like this, are they going to start burning into areas that have previously burned, and will it sort of contain itself because of the acreage we're talking about?
Well, certainly when you have a fire burn into an area that's already burned, there is lower fuel loading in many cases, right? I mean, you can have a lot of mortality, which then goes down and creates a lot of heavy fuels as well. So it's not an absolute. But if the fire weather is extreme enough, areas that have been burned fairly recently can burn again, but the fire will be less intense. And we've seen some of that in the last decade in areas, for instance, in San Diego County, where you'd say, really? You know, if the fire weather's, you know, high wind, low relative humidity, high temperature, if all of that's bad enough, yeah, a fire can carry across an area that you might not think could carry a fire, but there'll be less energy coming off of that fire, and it's easier to control and it's less destructive.
We're talking with UC Berkeley professor, or I should say Dean Emeritus, and professor of forest economics, Keith Gillis. Also with us from Cal Poly I'm assuming San Luis Obispo, professor of wildlife, fire, and fuels management, Chris Dykus. Professor, are you at SLO?
I am up in San Luis Obispo, yes.
All right, very good. So what more do you think that we could do to help deal with the fires of this magnitude?
Well, I'll agree with Dr. Gillis that we've certainly seen trends coming through with longer, drier periods and people moving out. When it comes to fire behavior, it's just it's fuels, weather, topography. And our landscape in California certainly got the topography. There's nothing we can do about that. And every year when it comes to the weather, we have hot, dry winds that kind of come like clockwork every fall that's there. And we can kind of count on it. One of the differences is noted is that by the absence of fire, we certainly have things are growing up tremendously, and people are trying to live in these wild areas, trying to be closer to nature. And we have to understand that nature in California is going to burn at some point.
What more could we do with building codes or siting? I mean, one of the challenges is, you know, people like to live in these forest door urban wildland interface areas because they're beautiful. Do you think that more should be done with the codes?
Well, some of it. Certainly California by far is the most progressive state in terms of laws, you know, around wildfire. And that's because we've had this bully fire coming, kind of punched us in the nose over and over and over. And some of the ways, like, we got to start fighting back with that. And we have started doing things like since 2008, we have this wildland urban interface building code that says we are the only state in the country that has codes, building codes surrounding around wildfire that we have to work with. Still, that's kind of incomplete. That's there, and we're constantly adjusting them and trying to expand them. You know, another thing that we're doing is defensible space around homes, and it's state law that we have to create this defensible space. But that law is only as good as it's being enforced. And in my experience, there's a lot of areas that have not been enforced in terms of this defensible space. So it's just like when the fire looks at the vegetation, it's fuel. And when it looks at a house, it's fuel. And it's just bleeding right up from the wildlands into the house in a lot of instances.
And are those rules on the books just not enforced?
No.
Go ahead.
I want to hear Chris on this as
okay.
well out there. This has been enforced since 2008, any type of new construction that's there. But we still have just a glut of housing that occurred, obviously, before 2008 that are still at tremendous risk.
That's Professor Chris Dykus, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Professor Keith Gillis of UC Berkeley, you wanted to say something about that.
Yeah, and Chris is right. So we've been taking steps, but like any of these building code issues, most of your infrastructure is the infrastructure you already have, not the stuff you'll build to a new code. And so how fast you move something into compliance with your modern codes, whether that's to respond to earthquake safety or dealing with flood zones as you've now mapped them out, or dealing with coastal threats from things like hurricanes, it's a slow process. I would say, though, the legislature's really stepped up and said, this is important and we have to get a grip on it. And they put more money into CAL FIRE such that we're running 250,000 defensible space inspections across the state on an annual basis. We're actually moving those inspections up to the level where you'd be seeing properties again on something like the maintenance cycle for the vegetation that a homeowner needs to be doing. So that's, I think, a very positive development. But there are some other things which are in the works.
All right.
I think the insurance industry's losses are such that they're taking a really hard look at this. And as the California Department of Insurance mentioned in a report that came out last December, there is not a strong feedback loop between the mitigation measures taken at the level of communities or homeowners and what insurance actually costs.
Gentlemen, I need to break there, but thank you both so much. As I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, Stan Lee, the publisher of Marvel, and really a personality apart from that in his own right, who's in all the Marvel Universe films with cameos, Stan Lee, dying at the age of 95 today. With me is LAist.com's arts and entertainment editor, Mike Rowe. Like me, Mike, I know you had a chance to meet Stan Lee and to talk with him. What a character. What an interesting guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that he really brought to comics was he was a champion of comic books. He was the guy who was the biggest promoter of comic books in modern times. You know, without him, we wouldn't have these Marvel movies right now. He fought for decades to be able to get projects like that made. He moved to Hollywood in the 70s and kept working at it until finally in the mid-2000s, he finally got Iron Man movies.
Well, and what's his importance in the evolution of comic books? Because, of course, we have the DC universe, Superman and Batman, and then we've got the Marvel universe of, you know, Iron Man and all the other characters. What's the difference?
You know, he was the guy who in the 60s, he was sort of sick of the way comic books had been done. He decided to bring sort of a very fresh attitude. He started talking to readers like in sort of everyday language. Instead of the sort of iconic Superman and Batman are sort of these perfect characters, PD created characters that had flaws, the characters that had anger issues, that had like the Hulk, characters that were nerds like Spider-Man and Peter Parker. He was the guy who brought sort of a modern sensibility to comic books and made it sort of helped comic books start to age up out of being just for kids and being for teenagers and for older audiences as well.
And in Lee's case, how big a role did he play in the transition into films? Because now these are the tentpole blockbusters at the movies.
You know, he was a guy who he fought a long time to get those made. He was trying to work. He managed to get sort of lower budget stuff made back in the 70s and into the 90s. A lot of lower budget studios made very cheap superhero movies. And then it finally took decades for that to happen. But they really all goes back to his source material. He co-created Spider-Man, the X-Men, the Hulk, so many of these characters that we know and love with the artists. He has a complicated legacy because he was sort of known known over the years for not giving that much credit to the artists. It took him a long time to finally get around to crediting some of his co-creators, but eventually that came to be.
Well, and the other thing about Stan Lee that stands out, I mentioned he's a personality in his own right. He was both creator and fan. He's like the biggest booster of comic books as well as a business person.
Yeah, you know, he started the practice of, he wrote like a letter column in every single comic book that came out from Marvel for decades, where it was called Stan's Soapbox, and he would talk directly to fans, help make them feel included, and he sort of created the modern fan movement himself.
Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to what you write for LAist.com,
as
you remember.
Larry.
Stan Lee, the man who created the Marvel Universe, the publisher of Marvel Comics, dying today at the age of 95 at his Hollywood Hills home. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We appreciate all the support that you give us right here at KPCC to keep providing you this coverage.